Welcome back, everybody, for another deep dive. Today we're going way back of the Old Testament stuff,
Yeah.
Nahum and Obadiah, and we've got this lecture here that really digs into these what they say about divine judgment on these empires, the Assyrians and the Edomites.
Yeah.
Just got me thinking, like, what can these ancient pronouncements of doom tell us about, like, how power plays out even today?
Yeah, it's so fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
You think these prophets would just be completely focused on, you know, Israel's immediate enemies.
Right.
But they weave in this much bigger idea that no nation, no matter how strong, can escape the consequences of its actions, you know?
It's true. And Nahum especially doesn't hold back.
No, he doesn't.
I was really struck by how he portrays God as this... warrior figure, you know, almost like a storm god himself, toppling the mighty Assyrians.
Right.
But wasn't that sort of how the Assyrians saw themselves too?
Exactly. They reveled in their brutality.
Okay.
Comparing their armies to these unstoppable natural forces. Wow.
We have accounts like the Babylonian Chronicle describing how they would impale their enemies, create these mounds of corpses. It was all part of their terrifying reputation.
So when Nahum uses this same storm imagery to describe God's power, it's almost like he's saying, you think you're fierce, you haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah, it's this brilliant rhetorical move. He's taking their own propaganda and turning it against them.
Wow.
You can almost hear the Assyrian king boasting, I raise my voice rumbling like a storm.
Right.
And then Nahum comes in and says, no, God is the true storm.
Wow.
And it's not just military defeat he's talking about. It's the dismantling of their entire worldview.
Okay, so that makes their downfall even more poetic in a way.
Yes.
But what about the Edomites?
Yeah.
They weren't exactly known for their military might, were they?
No, their downfall is more about treachery.
Okay.
They had this long-standing rivalry with Israel, but during the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonians, they really crossed a line. Not only did they stand by and watch, they actively exploited the situation. Oh, wow. Even joining in the looting and the violence.
So while Israel is suffering this immense loss, their own kin are profiting from it.
Yeah.
That's cold.
It really shook the Israelites to their core. You can feel that raw emotion in Psalm 137.
All right.
Where they lament the Edomites' cruelty and gloating.
Wow.
This wasn't just a political squabble. This was a violation of something sacred, that bond of kinship.
And Obadiah picks up on this, right?
Yes.
He doesn't just condemn their actions. He digs into the moral rot underneath it all.
Exactly. Remember, in that ancient context, betraying your kin.
Yeah.
Was a way graver sin than betraying an ally.
Really?
You were expected to show loyalty to your own blood no matter what.
Huh.
And the Edomites, by choosing opportunistic greed over that fundamental tie, they revealed a deep moral corruption.
And which Obadiah says will come back to haunt them.
Yes.
He warns of this day of the Lord.
Right.
A time of reckoning, not just for Edom, but for all nations that defy God's order.
And that's where things start to get really interesting.
Because this day of the Lord, it's not just some past event.
Right.
It's this recurring theme in the Bible suggesting that the tension between human power and divine justice is woven into the very fabric of history.
So these judgments on Assyria and Edom, they're not just ancient history. They're meant to make us think, could this happen to us? Are we repeating the same mistakes?
That's a question Obadiah would definitely want you to ask.
Yeah.
And that's what we'll explore further in the next part of our deep dive.
Okay, cool. Okay, so we've established these prophets aren't messing around.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, how did this divine judgment actually play out? Like, what happened to Assyria and Edom?
Well, for the Assyrians, it was a pretty dramatic downfall.
Yeah.
Nahum predicted the destruction of their capital, Nineveh, and it happened in spectacular fashion.
Yeah.
The Babylonian Chronicle describes the city being sacked, its treasures plundered, and its inhabitants scattered. It was a complete reversal of their former glory.
It's like their own brutality boomeranged back on them.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier how they used terror as like a tool of control.
Yes.
Are there any specific examples of that?
Oh, absolutely. One practice that comes to mind is flaying.
Flaying? What's that?
Essentially, they would remove the skin of a living person.
Oh my gosh, that's horrifying.
It was meant to be. This wasn't just about punishment. It was about sending a message.
Right.
Imagine witnessing something like that. The sheer terror would be paralyzing.
I can't even imagine.
It's no wonder they were able to maintain such a vast empire for so long.
So they ruled by fear.
Yes, very much so.
But Nahum is saying that even this level of calculated cruelty won't save them in the end.
Right. No human empire, no matter how terrifying, can stand against the ultimate power of God.
So in a way, they brought about their own destruction.
Yes, you could say that.
Wow, that's a sobering thought. Power built on fear and violence is ultimately unsustainable.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And that brings us back to the Edomites. Their story is less about military might and more about the consequences of violating a sacred trust.
That betrayal of their kinship with Israel.
Yes. You have to understand, in the ancient Near East, kinship wasn't just about blood ties. It was a social and religious obligation.
Huh.
To betray your kin was considered a grave offense, even worse than betraying an ally.
Oh, wow. So it's not just that they abandoned Israel in their time of need.
Right.
It's that they actively profited from their suffering.
Exactly. They saw an opportunity to grab land resources, maybe even settle some old scores.
Wow.
But in doing so, they severed a bond that went far deeper than political expediency.
And Obadiah is saying that this kind of moral bankruptcy will have consequences.
He's not just predicting their downfall.
Mm-hmm.
He's highlighting the spiritual implications of their actions.
Okay.
He's saying that their willingness to sacrifice kinship for short-term gains will ultimately lead to their own destruction.
That's a powerful message. It makes you think about how our own actions, even seemingly small ones, can have ripple effects that we might not even anticipate.
Absolutely. The choices we make, the loyalties we uphold or betray, all of these things contribute to the kind of world we create.
Right.
And the Edomites, through their actions, chose to create a world of division, exploitation, and broken trust.
And Obadiah is warning us not to make the same mistake.
Yeah.
He's saying, look what happened to them. Do you want to go down the same path?
He's inviting us to consider the long-term consequences of our actions, to ask ourselves, what kind of legacy do we want to leave behind? Do we want to be remembered for our greed and opportunism, or for our loyalty, integrity, and compassion?
Those are tough questions, but they're important ones to ask.
I agree.
Especially when we think about how these ancient stories connect to the challenges we face today.
Yeah.
Are there any modern parallels that come to mind when you think about the Edomites' betrayal?
Well, I think it's important not to draw simplistic comparisons.
Right.
But there are certainly times when we see nations or groups exploiting the vulnerabilities of others for their own gain.
Like how?
We see it in economic policies that prioritize profit over people. In political maneuvering, that prioritizes power over principles. And in interpersonal relationships where trust is broken for personal advantage.
So while the specific context might be different, the underlying dynamics of betrayal, greed, and the violation of trust are sadly still relevant today.
Absolutely. And that's why these ancient texts still have so much to teach us.
Yeah.
They hold up a mirror to our own tendencies, our own temptations to prioritize self-interest over the well-being of others.
It's a reminder that the pursuit of justice and righteousness is an ongoing task, both individually and collectively.
Exactly. We're all called to examine our own actions, our own motivations, and to ask ourselves, are we perpetuating patterns of betrayal and exploitation? Or are we working to create a world where trust, loyalty, and compassion prevail?
Okay, so we've seen how both Assyria and Edom faced divine judgment for their actions.
Yes.
But I'm still struggling with this concept of the day of the Lord.
Mm.
It sounds pretty apocalyptic. Is it really about a literal end of the world?
It's not necessarily about a literal end to everything. It's more about a dramatic intervention of God in human history, a time of reckoning where injustice is confronted and the balance is restored.
So it's not about God marking a date on his calendar.
Right.
But more about a time when things come to a head, when the consequences of our actions catch up with us.
Exactly. And it's important to note that the day of the Lord isn't always about punishment.
Oh.
It can also be a time of restoration and renewal for God's people.
Okay.
Think of it as a cosmic reset, a rebalancing of the scales.
So in the case of Assyria and Edom, the day of the Lord represents their downfall, the consequences of their actions finally catching up to them.
Right.
But for Israel, who had also experienced hardship and exile.
Yes.
The day of the Lord ultimately brought about restoration and a renewed sense of hope.
Precisely. It's a reminder that God's justice is multifaceted.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about punishing the wicked. It's also about vindicating the righteous and restoring balance to the world. And what's fascinating is that this concept of the day of the Lord doesn't just appear in these Old Testament books.
Oh, really?
It echoes throughout the Bible, suggesting that this tension between human power and divine justice is a constant throughout history.
So these judgments on Assyria and Edom, they're not just isolated historical incidents.
No.
They're meant to make us think about the bigger picture, about the patterns that repeat themselves throughout history.
Exactly. They're invitations to step back and look at the grand sweep of history to see how human choices, both individual and collective, contribute to the kind of world we live in.
Right.
And they challenge us to ask ourselves, where do we fit into this story? Are we on the side of justice and righteousness, or are we contributing to the cycle of oppression and exploitation?
Those are heavy questions.
Yeah.
But they're ones we can't afford to ignore. In the final part of our deep dive, we'll explore how these ancient prophets challenge us to live differently, to align ourselves with God's vision for a more just and compassionate world. So we've been talking about these judgments on Assyria and Edom and how they fit into this bigger idea of the day of the Lord. But I have to admit, it all feels a bit well intense.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something we should be worried about today?
Well, it's understandable to feel that way. The Day of the Lord is often described in, you know, very vivid, even apocalyptic terms.
Right.
But I think it's important to remember that the primary message isn't about fear or doom.
Wow.
It's about the ultimate sovereignty of God.
So it's less about predicting a specific event and more about reminding us that there's a higher power at work.
Yes.
Even when things seem chaotic or unjust.
That's a great way to put it. The prophets are essentially saying, don't get caught up in the immediate ups and downs of history.
Mm-hmm.
God is in control and ultimately justice will prevail.
That's actually pretty reassuring. But how does that play out in practical terms? What does it mean for us to live in light of this day of the Lord, even if we don't know exactly when or how it will happen?
Well, for starters, it calls us to humility.
Okay.
Both Assyria and Edom were brought low because of their pride and arrogance.
Okay.
They thought they were untouchable, that their power was absolute.
Yeah.
But the prophets remind us that all human power is ultimately limited,
mm-hmm.
and that we should never presume to be above God's judgment.
So it's a check on our own egos,
mm-hmm.
both individually and collectively. We're not the center of the universe.
Right.
And our actions have consequences beyond what we can immediately see.
Exactly. And this leads to a second important point, accountability.
Okay.
Nahum and Obadiah make it very clear that God holds nations accountable for their actions, especially how they treat the vulnerable and powerless.
Which is something we see echoed throughout the Bible, isn't it?
Yeah.
This idea that God has a special concern for the poor, the oppressed, the marginalized.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it challenges us to look at our own societies, our own systems of power, and ask, are we perpetuating injustice? Are we exploiting others for our own benefit?
So it's not just about avoiding punishment. It's about actively pursuing righteousness, making sure that our actions align with God's heart for justice and compassion.
You've hit the nail on the head. The day of the Lord isn't just some distant event we should passively wait for.
Right.
It's a call to action, an invitation to participate in God's work of bringing about a more just and equitable world.
And that brings me back to something you said earlier about how the day of the Lord isn't just about judgment, it's also about restoration.
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like, practically speaking?
Well, in the immediate context of Nahum and Obadiah, it meant the restoration of Israel.
Oh.
Their return from exile, the rebuilding of their nation.
Hmm.
But I think it points to something even deeper, something that goes beyond a specific historical event.
You mean it's about the ultimate restoration of all things, the kind of world that God intended from the beginning?
Precisely. The prophets are giving us a glimpse of that future, a world where justice and righteousness prevail, where the oppressed are liberated, and where the brokenness of this world is finally healed.
That's a powerful image. It makes these pronouncements of judgment feel less like doom and gloom and more like, I don't know, a promise of something better to come.
Exactly. The day of the Lord isn't the end of the story. It's the beginning of a new chapter.
Yeah.
And we as individuals and as communities have the opportunity to participate in writing that new chapter.
So what can we take away from all of this? If someone's listening to this deep dive, what would you want them to walk away with?
I'd say the main takeaway is that the pursuit of justice is an ongoing task. Mm-hmm. It's not something we can outsource to God or relegate to some future event. It's something we're called to embody in our own lives and our own communities right here, right now.
It's about aligning our own actions with God's heart, even in the midst of a world that often feels broken and unjust.
You've got it. And I think these prophets, with their stark warnings and their hopeful visions, give us a roadmap for that journey.
Right.
They remind us that even in the darkest of times, even when empires crumble and injustice seems to prevail, God is still at work, and we can be a part of that work.
That's a pretty hopeful note to end on.
Yeah.
Thank you for walking us through all of this. I feel like I've gained a whole new perspective on these often overlooked books of the Bible.
It's been my pleasure. These prophets deserve to be heard, and I think their message is as relevant today as it was centuries ago.
Absolutely. And to our listeners, thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it's given you something to think about, something to wrestle with, and maybe even something to act on. Until next time, keep seeking, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.